Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Today we're bringing three papers to you. The first, whether we should include reduced disclosure requirements for IFRS 17 in the consultation paper that we issue. Second, dealing with transition to a reduced disclosure standard. And finally, scope. So the first of those, AP31A, is on IFRS 17. And what we're asking you is whether the consultation paper should propose reduced disclosure requirements for IFRS 17. As you'll see from the paper, the staff do not believe that there are significant reductions that could be made to IFRS 17's disclosure requirements. In addition, as we set out in the paper, there are a number of other factors to consider with IFRS 17 that don't actually apply to the other standards that we considered. So with that, I'll stop there and take your comments.
Thank you, Elizabeth. So who would like to talk about IFRS 17 in the context of this project? Anne.
Thanks, Sue. Thanks, Elizabeth, for the paper. I actually favour consulting on IFRS 17 as part of the reduced disclosure standard. We know that there are some captive insurers, we don't know how many, but how many has not been a criteria that we've used in the past. And I think we need to consult, because if we don't consult, then we're in a difficult position following our consultation if we want to take action. By consulting, we put ourselves in a much better position if we want to include it. So the way I've approached this is to treat IFRS 17 the same way you worked through agriculture and extractive activities, rate-regulated activities. I've just treated insurance in the same way, IFRS 17 in the same way, rather than look at it from the other way, which you've also elaborated in the paper, which is to say, oh, can they be effectively reduced? I didn't do it that way. I tried to do it logically, lining up with the way we've approached other areas. And so I have concluded that I would put it in, even though you're saying you're not sure how much reduction could be there. Thank you.
Can I just clarify what you mean by consult, Anne? I think I know what you mean, but I want to be sure. So we could consult by saying we're not proposing to have reduced disclosures for IFRS 17. Please tell me whether you agree. We could consult by saying we're planning to have reduced disclosures, but we haven't decided which yet. Or we could consult by saying we're planning reduced disclosures and this is how we propose to reduce them. Which of the three are you?
Yes. Well, I would treat IFRS 17 the same as the other standards I mentioned, so therefore I would have proposals for reduced disclosures within the consultation document to enable people to say whether they wanted to proceed.
Okay.
Do they favour our approach?
That's
so
what I thought.
The third thing you
just
mentioned.
I think it's just helpful to make sure we're all on the same page. Okay, Mary?
Thank you.
Okay, I'll start out by declaring that I'm in the first of those three, Sue, that you just enumerated, which is to say we considered, you know, go out with our consultation document saying we considered and we are not proposing. And I have several reasons for that. First of all, I think it's a very complicated area. And if we expect there to be a relatively small population that would qualify as an SME, then I think the added complexity that everybody, you know, yes, you say you can just virtually or physically turn the page on that section, but it's another moving piece that's in there. Not the world's strongest argument, but just one thing to consider. Second, I think it would put a tremendous amount of pressure on which insurance companies qualify as an SME and which don't. And, you know, the staff has made the observation in the paper about if the entity issues participating contracts, then it is likely to be the kind of insurance company we thought would be a public interest entity and therefore would not qualify as an SME. And so that I think the kind of the cost benefit in terms of the population that might be able to consider using it versus the pressure and the complications lead me to support the staff recommendation of not proposing it. But I think probably more importantly, pardon me, I think that IFRS 17 disclosures are something we really, really need some experience with, at a minimum in the final stages of implementation, and ideally as actually applied in practice, before we can start making the types of decisions about that we need to, about which should be reduced or removed. Well, we can do it in theory. I think I think a simpler setting of understanding ECL with IFRS 9, we hear more and more about the importance of disclosures for understanding the recognition and measurement in that context. And I would be concerned with us doing this entirely as a theoretical exercise to come up with proposals in the standard. And while I understand your point that if somebody was interested in using it, they'd have to go through a period of doing the full set of disclosures before they moved to the reduced disclosures that would be available, I think the expectation that it would be relatively few entities and the fact that we could draw on so much more experience means that I would think overall it was better to wait, even if we did it as a standalone amendment to a reduced disclosure standard regime. So I support the staff recommendation for limiting the consultation to testing our initial conclusion of not providing a reduced disclosure regime for entities that issue insurance contracts. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Jin Chao?
Thank you, Sue. Yes, when I first look at this topic, the first impression I have is that I think we should not include in the scope, because current IFRS for SME standards, you know, did not cover insurance accounting, and IFRS 17, as Mary said, that it's quite complicated standards, and this standard has not yet been effective, so nobody has experience of implementing of IFRS 17. I think including users have no experience what information really useful, what information maybe not useful. But when I looked at the previous educational material, some stakeholders did raise that some specific insurance company, for example, captive insurance company, may be within the scope of the SME standards. And also, there is a worry that if we did not consider this issue in our forthcoming consultation paper, there will be a risk of re-exposure. So considering all these factors, I'm happy to include this issue in our forthcoming consultation paper. I agree with the staff's recommendation. But I do have two suggestions. First, I think that we should make it clear that the scope will be very narrow. Do not give the insurance company that some small medium-sized insurance company can apply IFRS for SME standard rather than applying IFRS 17. We should make it clear. Secondly, I did a little bit of research on captive, you know, insurance industrial practice. It seems to me that captive insurance company, those companies could be so-called very pure captive insurance companies. That means simply those companies simply parent only captive. And those companies could also be open market captive, also could be multi-parent captive, also could be association captive. So in this case, those cases, that means their business may involve outsiders rather than members of the rather than the parent company or members of the group. So I think maybe in the future, when we draft the document, in the basic conclusion, we should make it clear, you know, to clarify which we mean the captive insurance company, try to make it narrow as possible, and try to avoid any unnecessary confusion regarding the scope of SME.
Thank you, Jing Chao. Martin.
Yeah, thanks, Sue. And I agree with staff recommendation and all the arguments also Mary brought forward. Because man, I think we have not even discussed what if an insurance company which is qualifying for SME, what should be an appropriate disclosure. And I think we also cannot use what we have done currently with BC 157, because man, I think it is a kind of different primary users. Man, even if we have small insurance company and in many jurisdictions, I think that are regulated companies. And I think the interest of the regulator, we have to take also into account. And that is not what we usually think is a primary user of an SME, which is a bank, creditors. I think it's a different primary user perspective here, which we have to take into account. But even if we're doing that, I think that is not purpose of this project, because if we want to have what is appropriate for insurance companies which qualify for SMEs, that is a different project. Before we're discussing what should be reduced disclosure standards for a company which used full IFRS for recognition and measurement, and then decide, okay, about reduce, because we even don't know what should be the basic disclosure requirements for insurance companies which qualify for SMEs. Therefore, I think it is not part of this project, and I totally agree with staff recommendation. We should ask the question if we should do something, but I think we should not propose it. Thanks.
Thanks, Martin. Bruce?
Thanks, Sue. I'm unfortunately on the other side of the camp. I mean, I actually think we should be doing something on this, and I'll give you the reasons for it. So firstly, I'm supportive, we're going through the different options there, I'm supportive of us putting in proposed reduced disclosures. And the reason for it is, to start off with, I do think there's a market for this. What I mean is we've identified clearly that there are subsidiaries of insurance companies who would benefit from a reduced disclosure standard. I know two of the insurance companies I've received feedback from have said that they do think, I mean, they still want to work through it in a high level, but they said they do think there could be value, especially where these guys would meet the definition of a subsidiary. So I don't think this is necessarily a scoping question, and I don't think we should get confused. If we think this is a scope, the scope is a different issue. If we're saying if somebody manages to get themselves within the scope, do we think there's reduced disclosures that they can do? And I think if we start going through, I think there's that. Secondly, I think to me, my worry is that it makes the standard, this new standard, look a little incomplete in terms of we're saying we're just taking insurance and excluding it. Now, I do appreciate the comments everybody says, and this is a new standard. And yes, it is complex. But I guess from my side, when you take a look at it, it is new. We're not changing the recognition and measurement principles. We are trying to reduce some of the disclosures. And I think that with all the feedback, all the work that's been done, I don't think this is just a random shot in the dark. This is an educated assessment of what we think could be there. And I think it'll be interesting to ask the question of the insurers, who are the people currently implementing it, to see what they say. Lastly, the reason I would put everything in is I think that we reduce the re-exposure risk. And the reason I say that is if we've just put in a question saying, should we address insurance? If everybody comes back and says yes, well, from my understanding now, we need to re-expose something on that because we've never received comment on it. If we put something in now and we say these are the proposed reduced disclosures, if the overwhelming feedback is no, we shouldn't do anything, we should have left that alone, it's easy for us to take that decision and exclude it. If the overwhelming comment is yes, we think these are the ones we'd fix, or these are ones we can amend it. But I think that what we're doing is we're getting to a situation where we're kind of parking this and burying it. And if that's more of a strategic decision than a scoping decision, if we're deciding that we're going to take a new standard because it hasn't yet been implemented and exclude it, well, that's fine. But then that's got to be a decision we're going to kind of consistently hold on these things. And I just think that we should go out there and see what people say. And I think the problem is, it's a bit of that question of saying to people, should we do something? And they all come back saying, yes, you should do something. Well, what are you telling us you're going to do? In this way, we're saying, well, here's a proposal of what we think we could do in this area. Do you think that that would work? As I said, let's leave it to the insurers to comment.
Not sure how many insurers are going to comment on the reduced disclosure standard, but Rika?
Thank you, Sue. I agree with what Mary said about we consult being considered and not proposing and consult. And I would like to add a couple of reasons about this point. And one thing is, it's not necessary to create a disclosure of the IFRS for I mean, the purpose of the captive insurance company, because I think it's not necessary for it to provide the financial information among the group company through the general purpose financial statement. And if such general purpose financial statement are needed from external stakeholders communication, I think the reduced disclosure cannot help them communicate effectively. And also in terms of non-insurance companies' needs, I think if it will be a necessary or relevant issue for them, the lack of comprehensiveness of the reduced disclosure standard, if we get that kind of the feedback from the stakeholders, in that case, it might be worth thinking of it. So at this moment, I just wait for getting the feedback.
Thanks, Rika. Tadao?
Thank you, Sue. First, thanks to the team for the paper. I know that you have been doing a great work, especially in relation to find a way to reduce the disclosure using the BC 157, the principles there. And it is a hard work considering all the circumstances. We have not applied IFRS 17 yet, and then it just makes this work worst. As this is a proposed standard within IFRS, I would make a try in reducing the disclosure, even if this is a minimum reduction, and then ask in the document. At this point, I agree with Bruce. With this approach, I think that we can get more in terms of feedback than if we are just silent and ask. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadao. Francoise?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I started early on with this issue and believing we should have a consultation, and I continue to think that we should have a consultation. As some others have already stated, I would do so without proposing simplifications. For a number of reasons that have already been explained, I think, and very quickly, I'm not convinced that the population of beneficiaries is important, and I would like to have, through the consultation, an insight into that. That insight could bring an interesting feedback to us on how the publicly accountable entity definition or the non-publicly accountable entity definition is being applied or challenged in practice, because I regard insurance activities as bringing fiduciary fiduciary responsibility. So, what is the narrow camp exactly? And also, I would not spend, in fact, not knowing how beneficial and that kind of exercise may be. I would not spend time reducing or trying to reduce disclosures. I appreciate, as Tadeusz mentioned, the analysis that has been brought to us, because I think the staff has been bold in bringing this and has thought through. But I don't see there, and as the staff says, by the way, that we would have confidence that the reductions proposed would be fully in line with what we've done with the IFRS for SMEs more generally, or with other standards more generally. So open up the consultation on the basis of the current set of disclosures in IFRS 17, asking people whether that's a good decision in terms of who are the beneficiaries and what are the reduced disclosures that would be wanted if we had to reduce them.
Thank you, Francoise. Mary, before I let you in, I'm going to let you back in. I'm just going to make a couple of comments. So I also agree with the staff recommendation that we shouldn't propose reduced disclosures for IFRS 17 in the document. I would, however, say that we're proposing not to reduce the disclosures, so we are consulting on it. So we are, you know, saying something about it and asking for feedback. one of the reasons why I think that that's the better approach, in addition to comments others have made, is I agree with the staff's analysis that would suggest that we probably wouldn't be comfortable reducing the disclosures that much anyway. So I'm not sure that the benefits really justify the additional, the extent of change we'd be proposing anyway. And I'm not sure that it removes the risk of re-exposure, but I think it would be worth including in the basis, if the board agrees with that, the observation that on the review that what the staff did, the, you know, the analysis would suggest there wouldn't be a significant reduction in disclosures anyway. Because I think the more we can say about how we've thought about it, the more informed the responses that we can get. So people have got something more specific to react to as well, which is also helpful. But I agree with the staff's proposal. Mary?
And mine was just on the re-exposure point in particular. I think there'd only be a risk of re-exposure if we felt we could not issue the core document without an insurance component. On the other hand, if the feedback and what we consulted on led us to say we want to add reduced disclosure proposals for an entity applying IFRS 17, that could always be an almost immediate follow-on to the core document if we thought it was better to move ahead with one. So I didn't want just the risk of re-exposure to be something that was put out as a barrier, as long as people thought that it would be okay to have, you know, if we decided we then wanted to do something, to have it come along slightly behind, which I think marries up with the 2023 effective date for IFRS 17.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We could still complete the reduced disclosure standard, but we wouldn't necessarily be able to finalise the 17 piece of it. It would have to be done subsequently. Zach?
Apologies. I just wanted to join in and say I'm leaning towards the sides of either not including it in the consultation or putting forward the consultation with the statement that we're planning on not including it and requesting feedback. And the thought behind that for me is I really struggle with an expansion of the scope of the reduced disclosures. I think for the analytical community, looking at insurance companies is like looking at banks, where you have pockets of solvency and liquidity that are regulated. And so an innate understanding of where there's excess liquidity and where there's not is one of the key components of the analysis. So while they don't always have access to that information, I think any reduction in the disclosures that allow users to assess how much solvency and liquidity there is at entities is a step away from what they're looking for. And the counterpoint is you could just say, well, we're not going to reduce disclosures much. But then I think you really get into territory where the friction costs to the system of understanding a new set of disclosures at the user level, at the accounting profession level, at the preparer level, start to offset the marginal cost benefit of a few reduced disclosures. So for me, it doesn't really make sense from a cost benefit, because the only entity seeing reduced costs is the preparer. And everyone else has suddenly increased costs to be able to understand and assist and analyze what's being presented.
Thanks, Zach. Okay, so with that, I think we're ready to vote. And if it's okay with the staff, I'm going to reword what we vote on just very slightly. You're listening carefully, Elizabeth, so you can say no if you disagree. So what I'm ask the board to vote on is whether you agree that the reduced disclosure IFRS, that the proposals shouldn't include a proposal to reduce disclosures for IFRS 17. So we'll be explicit that we're not proposing to reduce disclosures. So there will be a question on this, but it will say we're not proposing to reduce the disclosures. Can I get the board show of hands for which board members support that?
Nine, one absent.
Okay,
Thank you. Right.
Sue, just a question, if I may.
Yes, sure.
I think it's important that we consult on the also the potential of beneficiaries, not only whether we should reduce them, but ask the question also, what are the entities that would benefit? So that we take advantage of this consultation to get a sense of what are these insurance activities that are not publicly accountable. Because I think it brings two benefits. It brings the benefit of knowing whether, in fact, it's worth doing something because the population is big enough. And second, it brings input to us on how our definition of not publicly accountable entities is challenged in practice. And so that's a domain of application which is very important.
Okay, so what you want to try and do is to try and find out how many entities would actually be affected by 17
what types.
Yeah, okay, right. Thank you. Tom, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I just want to support Francoise and what she said, because I think that publicly accountable should drive a lot of insurance companies, and it's hard to see which ones would survive the publicly accountable. So knowing a bit about both would really be helpful.
Okay. I think it's a good idea. I think we just have to work out how best to do it, but it would be a good piece of feedback. The thing that just makes me, there could be companies who aren't insurance companies who issue things that end up being insurance contracts. That's the only thing that keeps me, Sometimes if you issue particular types of odd warranties, for example, you can end up in the scope of 17, right, Laura? So it's not necessarily just sort of traditional insurers that might be captured, but I think it is good to try and get a read on the population because it helps us with our cost-benefit analysis as well. So I think we can take that on board. All right, Elizabeth, I think we're ready to move to 31B.
Thank you very much. So on paper 31B, which is about transition, we are recommending that there is no need to amend IFRS 1 and no need to include any transition provisions in the reduced disclosure standard. We also recommend that if a subsidiary applies the reduced disclosure standard, stops applying the reduced disclosure standard while continuing to apply IFRS standards, that comparatives should be required in that first year. In the first year, it goes back to full disclosures. Comparatives should be required for all the disclosures. And our proposal there is, if you agree with the staff on that, our intention is to actually draft something into the standard requiring those comparatives. We also recommend that you permit a subsidiary to apply the reduced disclosure standard for the first time more than once. And finally, we recommend clarifying that application of the standard is optional and that decision is reversible. And just on that latter point, I just need to draw your attention to something. In para 21 of the paper, I think it's a penultimate para, we have an example. And in that example, we have 2008-2, we have the subsidiary starting to apply the reduced standard, and in 2008-8, we have it stopping. And it was actually brought to my attention yesterday that the way we drafted it, the subsidiary would have no choice. It would have in 2008-8 because we said it's no longer eligible. So I just want to clarify, please read that as though we said the subsidiary chooses to no longer apply the standard, and all the remaining analysis about what we expected to do is exactly identical. But I just need to clarify that that's not only if it's forced to stop applying. So on that note, I will hand over for your comments.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Mary.
Elizabeth, support the staff recommendations. I just wanted to flag, I think it's four things that you made statements about in the paper that I think we should make sure to capture in the document, not necessarily as points of question, but I think we should be clear about these things and include them in any final reduced disclosure regime. They are the point about you're a first-time adopter of IFRS standards. If the first time you report using those standards, you use the reduced disclosure regime. That's, you have that in paragraph 9. In paragraph 16, that you are required to restate the comparatives when you move in or out. And also the point that you raise at the end about IS 8 not applying, that in other words, that you can move in or out, because I think if IS 8 comes up, it might be hard for an entity to move out to the reduced disclosure standard once it has applied full IFRS standards, given the hurdles for changes in accounting policy that are in IAS 8. So I think we should just be explicit about that. I also want to about all those three things. And I want to say I agree with your recommendation that we would in paragraph 9 that we would use IFRS, the first-time adoption section of the SME standard, to determine what disclosure requirements would be for somebody applying the reduced disclosure standard for the first time.
Thanks, Mary. Given nobody else is listed, I'll just make a comment as well, if that's okay. Sorry, Anne, if that's right. I agree with the recommendations that you have in here, Elizabeth, on all of these points. I agree with Mary that I think we can make it a little bit easier for people applying the standard if we're just explicit on a number of these points, so they don't have to sort of trawl through the standards to get there. One thing that I was confused by, and you were very helpful offline in terms of clarifying my understanding, was the whole interaction with IFRS 1. And that's because I have less experience applying the SMEs standard. And so usually if you're an IFRS, if you came in as a first-time adopter and through IFRS 1, you wouldn't look at other IFRS standards for the sort of disclosures that you would do as you come into IFRS 1. You'd look just at IFRS 1 and you wouldn't look at the disclosure requirements or transition requirements and other standards, because they only apply to people who are already in the full IFRS regime. And so I was thrown a bit by the idea that the transition disclosures would be in the reduced disclosure standard instead of in IFRS 1. Now I now understand that what you mean is there will actually be a section in the reduced disclosure standard that explains what an IFRS 1, somebody coming through IFRS 1, is doing in the context of reduced disclosure, and that makes sense. But what that really highlights for me is that I think we're going to have to think really hard about how we draft this standard, so that it's easy for people to understand what they're doing, because it can become very confusing, because you have to look at the full set of standards to look for recognition and measurement, and all of those standards have got disclosure sections, and we're going to have good signposting to make sure that people realize not to look at the disclosure sections in the main book, and when they need to be looking at the reduced disclosure standard. And you know, similarly, they might naturally pick up IFRS 1, but actually they're going to need to go to the new reduced disclosure standard to know what to do for the disclosure bit of IFRS 1. So I think we're just going to have to think carefully in terms of accessibility and complexity, if you like, to make it as easy as possible for somebody using this reduced disclosure standard to know how the heck that means they navigate through the big book in combination with this new standard, because it's a little bit of an unusual beast in the context of the big book. So I'm looking forward to the architecture. Anne?
My question was also about IFRS 1 first-time adoption. So, Elizabeth, I wasn't sure about the things that you can do within IFRS 1 that are special, for example, a revaluation property, plant and equipment as deemed cost. Would all of that just not be applicable because you're going to use the IFRS reduced disclosure will state to go to IFRS for SMEs for that guidance as you adopt? So that's a question.
Yeah, no, that's fine. All of the exceptions and exemptions that IFRS, that IFRS 1 gives, we would have remaining effective. It's only the disclosure requirements in IFRS 1 that we would exempt the subsidiary from, and instead they'd be giving the reduced disclosures. So the fact that you can use a previous revaluation as deemed cost of your PPE, that paragraph would still apply. The fact that there's a disclosure requirement about whether you've used that, that disclosure requirement wouldn't apply. Instead, you'd look up the reduced disclosure standard for what we're saying you must disclose. Sorry, if I make that clear.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you do it more than once? Can you do that deemed cost thing more than once as you come in and out of using?
Only if you're eligible to apply IFRS 1 more than once. And IFRS 1 itself allows entities to apply it more than once. So that's IFRS 1. We're not proposing altering that. And in particular, and maybe this is part of what Mary and Sue were also saying about ensuring we do clarify certain things in the standard. I would not. I think if a subsidiary is already applying IFRS with full disclosures and then started to apply the reduced disclosure, it would not be eligible to apply IFRS 1. So, but if it was sold to another group, that group it's now using some local gap, and then goes back to IFRS some years later, it would be eligible to apply IFRS 1. And therefore could, but it's nothing to do with the reduced disclosure.
It's a good example of my signposting, I think. So my understanding, if I get it right, see if I pass the exam, Elizabeth, is in the same way that if I was applying IFRS 16, I'd apply IFRS 16 recognition and measurement, I'd ignore the disclosure section and use the new reduced disclosure standard. Similarly, if I'm using IFRS 1, I use IFRS 1 for everything except the disclosure standard. I read the reduced disclosure standard. So it's the same principle for IFRS 1 as for everything else. Yeah.
It is, and I also take on board what you're saying, that IFRS 1 is different compared to all the other standards. So we could also ask an explicit question in the consultation document, whether, you know, and actually ask people to comment on whether they think it would be confusing if the IFRS 1 disclosures, the reduced IFRS 1 disclosures, are in the reduced disclosure standard.
Thanks. Rika?
I just want to one thing about the first time application of that reduced standard, not IFRS 1. I think given the restructuring of a group companies, that is a kind of the not the decision made by individual subsidiary. It's a kind of the group decision. So I think not to limit the first time application of the reduced disclosure once is sensible and operational, because it's not relating to how many times IFRS 1 standard can be applied. It's just a thing about how many times the company can use the reduced standards. Disclosure standards. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. Mary, did you want to come back in?
I did, just because I wanted to highlight another kind of statement, another conclusion about the interaction that I think we should be explicit about in any document in terms of the interaction with IFRS 1, which is if you move from not IFRS standards to IFRS standards using the reduced disclosure regime, you've already said explicitly in the paper that in that instance, you use IFRS 1 as modified by the reduced disclosure standard in respect of disclosures only. But I think it's also important to make clear our view that if you move from the reduced disclosure standard to full IFRS standards, without the reduced disclosure standard, that you are not a first-time adopter of IFRS standards. You do have to restate your comparative disclosure information, as I think you talked about in paragraph 16, but you are not a first-time adopter. Because of the oddity that you can be eligible to use I4S1 more than once, I think we need to be clear that this is not an additional circumstance in which you use I4S1.
Okay, we'll do that.
Okay, thank you, Mary. So I think we are ready to vote. Can we vote on questions 1 to 4 and 31B as a group? Nobody's twitching, so I think the answer is yes. Okay, in which case can I get a show of hands on whether the board agrees with the staff's recommendations on paper 31B, please?
One absent.
Thank you. Okay, moving on now to get on to paper 31C. Sorry, just opening it up here. So this, just to provide context, this is sort of more educational and directional. Is that correct, Elizabeth?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to tee up?
Well, I will, and I was going to say a little more than that, actually. That's fine. I will. So, as we just established, it is educational. The idea is to hold an exploratory discussion at this point, and we will bring a decision-making paper to you in January. And I just wanted to highlight the first part of the paper looks at possible scope limitations should you decide to limit the scope to subsidiaries that are SMEs. And the second part of the paper, as you will have seen, looks at options for broadening the scope beyond that, albeit not going beyond SMEs. I just invite comment. I don't know whether you want to start in the second part or the first part.
Don't you just outline both pieces of the paper and then we'll start the discussion, if that's all right?
The first part of the paper, if you limit the scope to subsidiaries that are SMEs, then one option is whether you limit the scope to single entity financial statements, and the staff actually don't recommend you do that. Although applying IFRS 10, we think very few subsidiaries will be required to prepare consolidated financial statements, or in fact, subsidiary that doesn't itself have subsidiaries that has, for example, an associate, equity accounting, we do know that there are jurisdictional requirements that mean that some subsidiaries could nevertheless have to prepare consolidated financial statements. So we don't recommend limiting to single entity financial statements. The other possible limitation within subsidiaries is whether to limit it to subsidiaries whose parents prepare financial consolidated financial statements applying IFRS standards or are required to apply IFRS standards. We don't suggest limiting it to requiring, but we do think in the whole spirit of the original project objective, we limit it to those whose parents do prepare consolidated financial statements. And on that, an entity could be a subsidiary at the start of its year, throughout the whole year, or just at the end. So we are actually recommending you limit it to those subsidiaries that are subsidiaries at the end of their year, because otherwise an entity could apply there, but not actually a subsidiary at the point they're applying it, albeit they were at the start. On the second part of the paper, the widening of the scope, for similar cost-benefit reasons to subsidiaries, you could consider extending to joint ventures, to joint operations, to associates, to parent entities in their own single entity financial statements. But in some jurisdictions do accompany the consolidated financial statements that they prepare. And I think for any of those, it would be the same cost-benefit reasons that we've looked at for subsidiaries. You could look at going even wider, the last two, which is you could extend to parent entities in their consolidated financial statements as well, whereas in the first part of the paper, I'm talking only about subsidiaries that are themselves parents. Here we're talking about being potentially the entire group, and finally you could extend to all SMEs. Now, the staff are not recommending widening it beyond subsidiaries that are SMEs, primarily because I think that would create a third tier. And that was my understanding, was to try and avoid that. And I think there are repercussions for the IFRS for SME standard as well. So with that, I'll hand over.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Françoise, do you want to kick off?
Yes, thank you. And first, I would like to thank the staff for this paper, which was a difficult paper to write, and I know a lot of efforts have gone into it, and I really appreciate. And I will start, in fact, with discussing the latter part of the paper, because depending on how you think about that latter part, you may answer to the other question at the same time. I would so start with whether we should open up or not. And I think when I think of that issue, I really think of the ISB overall credibility and how we would, you know, respond or our standard setting responsibilities to whoever would ask questions about it. And I look at the arguments that the staff put forward in favor of their recommendation, and they're in paragraph 27. The first point that Elizabeth has just outlined, which is we would be creating a third tier, and very helpfully in the paper, we see a reference to the objective that we set to ourselves in the beginning. And in the beginning of a project, you know, you start from a request and you consider that request in its own right, and then you analyze and you do better. And indeed, we had made the decision that we did not want to create a new third regime, that you would have IFRS, something else, and the IFRS for SMEs. When we made the decision that going forward, so that was the decision that we made subsequently, after having started the project, after having done analysis, we concluded that the way to respond to the request was to create one standard part of IFRS. In making that decision, we have eliminated any possible risk of creating a third tier, because basically what we are doing is completing our set of IFRS standards with a standard that considers specifically the needs of a particular group of entities. Exactly, in a wider manner, but exactly in principle, as we do with IFRS 8 and IS-33, that ask supplementary requirements for some entities which are publicly accountable entities. Here we are reducing the set of disclosure requirements for those who are non-publicly accountable. We are within IFRS. There is no doubt that's the decision we've made. Then we cannot go to our public, to our constituents, and say, we have decided on the scope, that the second argument, and basically we have kept the scope that of the initial request we've received, just because we didn't conduct research. I think we have the responsibility of conducting research as much as is needed before making our decisions. The third argument that is in 27C is no more than an argument against the project itself. Because it suggests that, you know, if you are IFRS, then you want to have all disclosure requirements. And this is true for a subsidiary as much as for any other entity. And it moves away, doesn't consider the user's needs anyway. But so this argument is against the project itself. So I'm really in favor of extending the scope, and it is not a preference. It is the logical conclusion of what we're doing. We're considering a set of entities that is well defined with this definition that we have in the IFRS for SMEs. We have considered the user's needs, and the staff very helpfully reminds us that there has not been any decision that we've made in selecting what disclosures requirements should be kept that has a link to an entity being a subsidiary. So there is no link between restricting the scope and the set of disclosure requirements. None. And so if we were not extending the scope, we would have to respond to jurisdictions, to whoever asked us to explain what we're doing. By saying, oh, here you have a set of entities. You have rightly analyzed that when you're not publicly accountable, such as subsidiaries, you should limit your reduced disclosures in order to fit a user's needs. But we have excluded the entire population of these other entities, which are not subsidiaries. Why are we imposing on users disclosures that we have decided, we have analyzed, are immaterial to them? Why are we doing that to users? Second, why are we imposing the cost of those entities? Why, in terms of standard setting responsibility, how do we justify that this cost would be beneficial in one case and not in another, when the user's needs are exactly the same? Then in terms of this would create confusion in the market. I really think that in including this new IFRS in our set of IFRS, we're completing the set, and we're removing a pressure on the IFRS for SMEs that has existed right from the outset. And that pressure comes from, we have had small and medium entities in mind. We've given that as a title, even though as a standard setter, we could not make decisions in terms of size. We had to make decisions in terms of users' needs. So we have come with a definition, a scope for the IFRS for SMEs, which is a scope based on the definition of not publicly accountable entities. There is no consideration of size, and there could not have been one. So we know that the IFRS for SMEs can attract in its scope very large entities, very small, and so the size itself is not a criterion for us. It is, however, a criterion for jurisdictions. So, and it is the responsibility of jurisdiction to decide whether to adopt IFRS, whether to adopt the IFRS for SMEs, and to decide to what entities in their jurisdiction this or that standard should apply. In terms of our standard setting responsibility of the IFRS for SMEs, having the needs of large non-publicly accountable entities well taken care of in the full set of IFRS removes some of the pressure we have for simplifying the IFRS for SMEs if there is a need to. And I'm very interested in what we've learned from the comprehensive review that we have undertaken of the IFRS for SMEs, and we considered 2 days ago, that tells us people support alignment, but they would like a wider scope for simplification. And so I really think that there is no argument for no standard setting rational argument to restrict the scope, and there are only good reasons to extend it. Thank you for that long speech.
Okay, I think we know what Françoise thinks. It's very passionate. Thank you, Françoise. Tadao.
Thank you, Sue. Thanks for the staff for preparing this paper. I agree with Francois about the hard work in putting the arguments for both views, and we know how the staff work hard to get that one. Well, I believe all SMEs should be allowed to use the IFRS reduced standards, I mean that the extended scope. IFRS is used in more countries than IFRS for SMEs, something like 144 against 81. In the countries where IFRS is used, but not IFRS for SMEs, many SMEs could use IFRS with reduced disclosures instead of, for example, using a local GAAP. And because of this, they may not have access to more relevant capital markets or may have more costs in raising capital. Even in countries where IFRS for SME is allowed or required, an entity may want to apply IFRS full because its competitors are using IFRS or because they are about to meet the requirements that will make IFRS required for them, not imminent, but they are about to. Also, investees other than subsidiaries, and we mentioned that in the paper, such as joint ventures and associates, may also need to report numbers in full IFRS to the investors. If we limit this to the subsidiaries, these companies would be out. Definitely doesn't make sense in my view. Also think about first-time adopters. SMEs applying IFRS for SME for the first time may believe the cost of implementing IFRS or IFRS for SME is quite similar when I'm talking about first-time adopter, not IFRS for SME to IFRS. So just moving from my local GAAP to one of these two. Because of the reduced disclosure standards, they may prefer to apply IFRS as this is a more internationally accepted standard. And anyway, in the future, it's likely that they will need to apply IFRS if the company keeps growing or wants to go public. I think that Françoise mentioned that one, the proposed reduced disclosure standard is not a third set of standards. It is IFRS. The reduced disclosure is simply a pre-materiality exercise considering the type of the company, looking at the user needs. An SME applying IFRS full could try to achieve the reduced disclosure doing a materiality exercise, for example, but it's much easier if we have the reduced disclosure standards. That's my considerations. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadao. Jinchao.
Thank you, Sue. I think actually it's really a big issue for this project if we think about to expand the scope to of this standard to from subsidiaries or SMEs to whole population of SMEs. From my point of view, we should be very careful. A couple of points. I think firstly that on the current financial reporting framework, I think it's clear we developed IFRS for IFRS standards. This standard is applicable to those entities which have public accountability. We developed IFRS for SME standards. This standard applicable for those companies who have no public accountability. So this is very clear to the users and to stakeholders. And if we expand this, you know, project to be applied to whole population of SMEs. Also, we said that this reduced disclosure, you know, standard will be part of the IFRS standards. But from stakeholders' perspective, from SMEs, they do have three options. One is IFRS standards. One is IFRS for SME standards. Another one is IFRS standards with reduce the disclosure requirement. From users, they also needed to make sure which standard they apply. Three options, three standards there. So although we say this standard will be part of IFI standards, but from users, from preparers, they do have three options there. I really worry about it will cause some kind of confusion. From standard global standard setters point, I always believe that we should not provide too much options to stakeholders. We should be careful when we provide additional options to stakeholders. So this is the first point. We should have strong, views, reasons to develop additional options. Secondly, come back to why we need this project, why we need to provide, reduced disclosure for those subsidiaries or SMEs. It's come back to our initial objective of this project. Because I never think about that, we can change this object, because this project is the result of 2015 agenda consultation. Before that, we didn't have this kind of request. And there are several comment letters raised this issue. When I look at all those comment letters who raised the issue, they only raised the question that whether we can simplify the disclosure requirement for those subsidiaries, because their parent company apply IFI standards. So it causes additional cost for them. So because those subsidiaries, they needed to apply recognition measurement requirement of IFI standards. I think it's logically fair, because those subsidiaries are SMEs. They are eligible to apply IFIs for SMEs, but because parent company apply IFIs for IFI standards, so they have no choice. They needed to apply the required recognition and measurement requirement for of IFI standards. So I think this is consistent with initial objective, initial request from stakeholders. Thirdly, I really agree with the analysis made by the staff of paragraph 27C. From users' perspective and from our whole package of IFI standards perspective, when we develop those disclosure requirements, I think initially we think that those disclosures are equally important with other parts of the standards, recognition, measurement, presentation, and disclosure. They are integrated together, and they are internally, closely, linked, connected to each other. So when we go to the disclosure part, we say, okay, we can reduce some part of them. I think it's caused some kind of confusion, and it's not consistent with each other. So this is third part. I think we should be careful if we spend the scope to a larger population, especially a whole population of SMEs. So come back to the first issue and the second issue. First is that staff recommended the reduced disclosure standards should not be limited to the single entity financial statement. I agree, because we have no reason to exclude that if a subsidiary prepare consolidated financial statement, they should also be available to be allowed to apply these standards. Secondly, with regard to the question whether the scope should be limited, to the subsidiary with a parent, whether the parent only could be applied to those parents applying local GAAP or other standards. I think we should not, because the initial objective is to focus on those parents, already apply IFI standards. So I agree with that. The staff's recommendation, we should focus on those parents present their, consolidated financial statements applying IFI standards. Also, not only limited to those parents require them to apply IFI standards. So I agree with the first and the second staff's recommendation.
Thank you, Jing Chao. Nick?
Thanks, Sue. So I would say my position is probably quite closely aligned with that set out in the staff preliminary review in paragraph 38, and particularly in favour of retaining the existing scope. I'm very supportive of the reduced disclosure regime for subsidiaries, but all the same, this is new territory for us, and I'm inclined to avoid any unforeseen consequences or confusion in the market and prefer a kind of one step at a time approach. So I wouldn't rule out eventually widening the scope, but I'd much rather do that on an incremental basis. So let's get this over the line. Let's stick to our original scope to begin with. And within time, if we want to reconsider the question of whether it's appropriate to extend the scope, I'd come back to that. But today I would stick to where our focus has been for this project. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Mary?
Nick did a better job than I could have of expressing my view. So I want to sign on to everything he just said and maybe just to say something about how I was thinking about it. I think when we think about who are the stakeholders for this project, the stakeholders are not just those who would apply this reduced disclosure regime, but they're also everybody who has bought into the whole IFRS standards and adoption of IFRS standards and what that means and what they can expect. And, you know, Nick talked about being cautious and incremental. And one of the reasons I think we should be cautious and incremental and, you know, consider broadening the scope only once we've proved the base case is for all those who said, hey, we bought in because we thought when saying I apply IFRS standards, it meant X. And maybe, you know, this is the backstory kind of thing on concerns about a third regime, a third tier of IFRS standards and why it's a risk. So I was nervous about this project. It could, you know, I'm comfortable that we're in safe hands with the staff that is leading it in terms of thinking. But I absolutely line up with Nick's recommendations in terms of how we do the risk management, try to get this project across the line and get experience with it before we talk about expanding the scope.
Thanks, Mary. Bruce?
Thanks very much, Sue. I am strongly opposed to extending the scope on the project, and I'll give you my thinking around why I was there. To start off with, I truly believe we have a solution out there for non-publicly accountable entities. We've put it out there. The SME standard is available. And yes, I accept it's not as adopted as full IFRS, but I mean, it is still a solution that is widely being accepted. And I think that if you take that into account, plus that we're now starting to discuss an alignment principle, my worry is we're going to have these two situations which are going to get closer and closer, but there'd be a difference between them. I think the other thing you've also got to consider is don't discount the impact this will have on adoption of IFRS for SMEs. If we now come out with a proposal saying that there's potentially another solution somewhere between the two, I think countries who are even thinking about adopting SMEs or newly looking at it would just turn around and say, well, let's wait till see what that does. So I think it can very heavily impact on the adoption of the SME standard. Secondly, I'm a big believer that IFRS is a gold standard, and it worries me that we have a situation where now within IFRS there are two frameworks within that, and we can go through the argument of whether it's another framework. In my mind, it is, because a framework, if you think about it, is a set of principles in which I can formulate my financial statements, my auditors can audit those and express an opinion on that, and that is in essence what we're setting up here. So I think be conscious that as much as we're saying it's not a second framework, it is, because we're going to have a standalone set of accounts not complying with full IFRS on which people are expressing a view, directors are signing off. So I'm worried that we're going to end up with that confusion in the market that somewhere along the line somebody's going to say, which IFRS is this? I also think that you've got to consider this would change the assessment of how we do the standard setting in this area going forward. If I look at things like, it was mentioned, IFRS 34, if I look at things like even IFRS 10 where we have the exemptions, to me, the safety in that we've had exemptions and we allow things like interim accounts that don't necessarily comply for IFRS is because somewhere along the line, there is a full set of IFRS accounts. So to me, the security has always been that where we give exemptions for subsidiaries and standalone accounts, where we give the interims that reduce, there is a full set of accounts somewhere along the line. That gives me the safety in terms of this project in saying that we still have a consolidated group set of accounts that's prepared under full IFRS. The moment we extend out of that, we change that, which means now we are in a situation where every time we look at the disclosures, we have to say, well, hang on, are we happy that these would stand alone? As opposed to, are we happy that these are things that maybe are included at a group level that we wouldn't necessarily need at the SME level, at the subsidiary level? So that's another thing that would worry me. Last thing I'd point out is I think that if we extend the scope, we need to be careful that doesn't impact on adoption or endorsement in various countries. Because the moment we extend the scope to now say, hang on, this could also be a standalone framework for whatever it may be, you can end up in a situation where some countries going, well, hang on, we're not happy if we're allowed to give people something other than the full IFRS, which means where we've got an advantage for SMEs, that could be delayed in certain countries because the regulatory regime is saying, hang on, we now need to assess, we'll be happy for this to work on a standalone. Otherwise, we're going to have to start amending the scope ourselves. And then the question is it IFRS? And we end up with that whole big mess. So I would I say never in the future? I like the way Nick articulated it. I think let's kind of say maybe this is something we're going to come back to and have a discussion once this thing is over the line. But I think for now, I'd be very concerned that we're going to cloud and we're going to lose focus on this project on the basis that we can get this thing done. This thing could derail it.
Thanks, Bruce. Rika?
Thank you, Sue. I think I agree with the staff's preliminary views, and I really like how Nick articulate his position. So I would like just add what I thought. I think in terms of the third tier question, this is not the creation of the third tier, because once it is elected, the entity should apply all requirements in the IFR standard and look at other IFR standards through the window of this reduced disclosure standard. So in this context, it is a little bit like IS34 or IFRS1 to use that window to see the full IFRS requirement. So because of that, I think I really think we need to stick to the original starting point of restricted scope, because our whole project discussions were all made based on this project's original objective and the targeted companies of this project to meet the need of the users of the financial statement of the subsidiary that are SMEs. So I think we need to have a consistent point of view on that. And so if we have to expand the scope, I really want to ask the staff to redo some work to ensure the impact of the changes in the scope. Thank you.
Tom?
This is turning into a challenging issue. I wanted to, first of all, I think I do get concerned, though, with labeling. And I think in our discussions, we should be absolutely clear about what we're doing. And third tier connotes sort of a totally standalone thing. This is clearly not. So what is it, in fact? So currently, if you think of a 2x2 box, one column is recognition and measurement. Second column's disclosure. The rows are full IFRS and IFRS for SMEs. And up till now, the IFRS, if you did the IFRS recognition measurement, you had to do IFRS disclosures. You did IFRS for SMEs recognition measurement. You did IFRS for SMEs disclosures. And so what we've said at the beginning of this exercise is, would it be beneficial to take the IFRS for SMEs disclosures and allow some entities that are using IFRS recognition and measurement to basically do the diagonal? And we build a few bridges, the ones that relate to recognition and measurement. That was the approach to essentially, so I would say third tier is misleading in the sense that nothing new save the few little bits of bridge has been created. So if you say third tier, somebody's going to say, oh my God, you're doing a whole third. That's not the case. So a tiny little bridge gets created. And then the second thing is that we're actually planning to create it. So we're going to create it for subsidiaries that fulfill a certain IFRS for SMEs plus some other criteria. And so having created it, if we make it a little bit bigger, is that going to be a really bad and awful thing? To be honest, I'm not absolutely sure. I didn't find the four arguments put forward in the paper against doing so convincing. I won't go into why, because that's not the point, and we can have that discussion later. And then there's talk about testing and waiting, but let's suppose that this truly is beneficial for the subset of SMEs that would want to use it. Should they wait 10 years? Which is what, by the time we put it out, test it, redo, it's going to be at least 10 years before we give them something that, if it were to be clearly beneficial to them, we would not be doing. And so, to me, it's not so much choosing today whether we expand or not, but at the minimum, I think we should be consulting on this. Everybody, I'm hearing a lot of things about what regulators would do, and you know what different people would do, and what lenders might do. Maybe it'll facilitate lending. That's part of our role, is to facilitate the operating of capital markets. Maybe some lenders would actually like this, that they don't need the disclosures. And I was on the Canadian group that created the Canadian private entity standard. And it is true that disclosures, when we talked to lenders, they didn't need the full range of disclosures. That, at least in Canada, was a fact. And they were happy, though, to get certain recognition and measurement. And sitting here, I really don't know about all the things, and I don't know how we can know without asking the question in some form. So I'm on balance, I totally agree. I think Francois has made excellent arguments. I would be slightly perhaps less aggressive in that, in the end, I really don't know. I think there may be some risks, but we can't find out what the risks are with any accuracy without asking the question. So I'd really like to ask the question, which then even brings us, though, to the really awkward question. If we were contemplating a discussion paper, this would be much easier. If it's an exposure draft, you have to go out with very strict particulars, and I won't even go there, but I would, in the end, strongly argue that we ask this question in a reasonable way. And I'll just kind of close with when I was doing some goodwill outreach with the goodwill staff. Some people, this actually came up, some people said, you know, it would be a really great thing if you guys could create essentially this SMEs, full IFRS recognition measurement with reduced disclosure. And it just came up, you know, spontaneously. So some people out there seem to care about it in that sort of ad hoc interaction I had. So I would like us to ask in some reasonable form if we could agree on what the reasonable form is.
Thanks, Tom. Martin?
Yeah, thanks, Sue. And I also agree with the staff's view, and also especially what Nick and Mary said, because I think there is a big risk that we're really creating a third tier of IFRS and standards. And maybe it is, for some circumstances, where maybe companies, SMEs, want to use full IFRS with the reduced disclosure is appropriate. But it is another standard, and if an entity of the same size is not designing that, I think that reduces comparability between these entities. And there's also, I think we will, if we have or maybe already this kind of risk that some people are saying, okay, why not, why isn't then this full IFRS with reduced disclosure not appropriate for listed companies? Maybe for some kind of listed companies, for listed companies with smaller size. But all that, I think, if we then increasing the kind of what people can use, the overall idea of full IFRS for everybody. I think the overall idea was to have comparable financial statements for certain kind of entities. And if we maybe now having a third tier, why not having a fourth tier? Maybe it is appropriate for some entities, but I think it is against the overall idea because we are not deciding what companies are doing. That is based on jurisdictions. And I think that if we're doing that, maybe there will be starting discussions in some jurisdictions and saying, okay, why not using this full IFRS with reduced disclosure for even listed companies? If that is appropriate for big companies which are not listed, why not for others? And I don't think that is really not the scope of this project. And I have said that also at the beginning of the project, because I think that is reducing cost for some entities. And if you want to have a discussion, what is IFRS appropriate for other standards, it's a different project. And therefore, I'm totally with what the staff has recommended and not in favor of extending the scope of that. Thanks.
Thanks, Martin. Anne?
Thanks, Sue. This is a great discussion. I actually want to talk about the staff and what they might do next. But just for completeness, I was probably going to be in the yes camp, and I won't repeat the reasons with Françoise and Tadiel and potentially possibly Tom. But we've had lots of good points on the other side, and if we were voting today, we'd actually be voting on a narrow scope based on what we've heard. So I just want to talk to the staff and ask where you want to go from here, because you've talked about, I thought I saw January, I thought I saw coming back on this point in January. And a couple of people have said, we need more research, we need to understand it better. And I really hesitate over that. So I want to talk to that point. What I hesitate over is this is so hard to research, because what's the research supposed to do? Is the research supposed to measure the demand for this? Or is the research supposed to find out the possible consequences of an extended scope? It's a big and it's a hard question, and it's a big question, and therefore it's time consuming. And we're all conscious of time, and we're conscious of wanting to be able to get the consultation document out and progress this work. So my thoughts were for staff whether you could bring back the decision paper, the voting paper, with you can build on the arguments for both sides based on what you've heard today, and maybe you could help people make their decisions by illustrating what the choices would be from the narrowest to potentially the broadest and possible consequences. And you could illustrate that by considering example countries. For example, Françoise has got some thoughts around European Union, and Tadiel has got some thoughts around Brazil. And we know that Australia actually would have been a country to adopt this for all, a large group that wasn't IFRS subsidiaries. Australia would have adopted it, but it didn't exist, so they wrote their own. And we heard about that last year. So I'm suggesting that the research needs, if staff are going to do endeavour in this paper to provide more background, to not to make it a huge project for themselves, but to set out all the arguments that have been presented, consider possible consequences and how that might play out, you know, how countries might or might adopt and take it into their own law, that sort of thing. And potentially just to consider some examples of different scenarios, because I think to try and do a comprehensive study of how this would work and what countries would be involved, where the demand is and possible consequences, I think that's way too hard. I think that just is too hard. And so I've tried to think of ways that you could bring back the paper with additional analysis and investigation without weighing yourselves down. They're my comments. Thank you.
If it's okay, I'll maybe at the end, staff, you could comment on next steps once everybody's spoken, if that's all right. Is that okay, Anne? So we'll come back to answer your question, if that's okay.
Sure.
Françoise wants to come back in, but I was just going to make a few comments first, if that's okay. I also agree with the staff's current thinking in terms of the scope of the project. And I, in particular, agree with the points that Nick made and also the points that Martin made in addition to the comments that are in the paper.
I think another couple of things that I thought about as well, just to flag for the further analysis the staff is doing, I'm particularly concerned about what the effect might be on this model that we're developing if we were to think about a broader scope and what that means in terms of the complexity, but also the focus of this project. So at the moment, I think we have a relatively simple basic proposition, which is that we've got a set of stakeholders who are wanting to apply recognition and measurement in accordance with full IFRS because they're part of a group that applies full IFRS ultimately. So it's in their interest to have full alignment, if you like, with the recognition and measurement requirements, but the reduced disclosure is helpful for them for their own financial statements. And I worry that if we move away from a population which is consolidating into a full IFRS group and we broaden the population to entities that aren't full and part of a full IFRS family, that we might start to get the same pressures that we get when we're looking at SME considerations, which are valid pressures, to think about the speed of change because of the burden of the pace of change in full IFRS for a community that is got smaller preparers as part of that community. And I would worry that if we move to a population that isn't sort of tied to the recognition and measurement of a consolidated group, that will start to have a pressure or pull and considerations of how quickly we should adjust the recognition and measurement. And it's just going to add complexity to the idea of this standard. The other thing that I think we just need to be careful of as a board is that if I were to be critical of us and listening to us, I think there's almost an underlying tone that we ourselves might buy into the idea that the disclosures in full IFRS are unnecessarily burdensome. Whereas I hope that if you're thinking about who your primary users are and applying materiality well, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. And surely our primary consideration should be making sure that for all IFRS appliers of the full book, that we're getting the disclosures right and in a way that they can apply it proportionately and appropriate for who their users are, rather than saying, well, that's a big, big, big load of disclosures for everybody and there's no getting away from it. And so we have to have this reduced disclosure regime. And I think we just need to be a little bit careful about that. I had one very specific point on the front part of the paper, if that's all right, the stuff on paragraph 22. And this was this idea that you needed to be a subsidiary at the end of the reporting period to be eligible for the reduced disclosure standard. I just wondered about the practical implications of that. So if you're a company that had been part of a group, you know, for most of the year, and then you're suddenly sold toward the end of the year, which might not be your choice, but your parent sells you, would I then potentially have to upscale suddenly to full IFRS because I've already got my recognition and measurement, but I suddenly need to apply the bigger set of disclosures quickly, which might be very difficult to do, or alternatively think, oh my God, actually I want to go and be part of the SME regime, but I may have to change recognition and measurement. So I'm just worrying a little bit about the practicality of a sort of sudden change of the scope of the regime that you're in, based on a change in ownership that you might not be able to control as a subsidiary. And so I just wondered in that paragraph 22 recommendation, how practical that might be for somebody to be kicked out of scope at the, you know, 11th hour in the reporting period. So I just wondered if we could have a think about that. Françoise, you wanted to come back in.
Yes, and I promise to be quick. I think, you know, we left the board meeting in October with the request that we would have a fuller discussion of what we were trying to accomplish. And I think this discussion is really helpful in that regard. To me, in fact, this has really clarified a number of arguments in favor of a reduced scope. I don't think I find them convincing because when we say recognition, recognition, measurement, and disclosures are intrinsically linked, we should not dissociate them. That is true for subsidiaries, that's for everybody else. When we say, oh, I start with subsidiaries, but I'm not so sure whether I should be doing this, It's like, you know, playing the witch apprentice with the subsidiaries being possible scapegoats. And that's where I think, you know, I refer to our standard setting responsibility. If we think that there are risks, we should investigate more. We should not set requirements, reduce disclosure requirements without the confidence that we are doing the right thing. There is no population to sacrifice to a lively test experience if we do not think that we are doing the appropriate thing. And when I consider the argument, and in fact the basis for this proposal of the staff of opening up that possibility only to those subsidiaries which are part of a group that reports under IFRS, I think it's a denial of the subsidiary being a reporting entity by itself. It denies, you know, the needs of that subsidiary uses financial statements. So I would, as someone has said, of course, want to have a question as a minimum if our, as a group, we come to the conclusion that we should restrict the scope. And I would, I think that the last highlight that you made on this impossible situation of a subsidiary that applies a reduced set of disclosures and all of a sudden has a full set because it's no longer part of the group, but the group reports under a different regime. I think it shows that we have no link to users' needs. So thank you for allowing me so much time on this issue. And I've been passionate about the discussion itself.
Yes, definitely passionate. Everybody, of course, wants to do the right thing, but sometimes we've got different ideas of what the right thing is. Elizabeth and Michelle, did you want to say anything about sort of what your thinking is on terms of next steps? Or are we putting you on the spot? I think the idea from what I understood was that you were going to listen to this analysis and build out the papers and then bring us back something to vote on. Is that the idea? I'm not sure how much we want to get into, you know, different types of entities and jurisdictional things. Sounds like quite a bit of work, but do you want to give us a little bit of an idea of what we might see next?
Michelle, shall I start and then you can add something? Yeah. Sorry, I can't see your image on my screen, but anyway. So I'll start and say something and please then say something at the end. So I think you probably summed up roughly where I was at. So I've got pages and pages of notes. The intention had been to bring a paper back next month, building on the one we put to you today. I've obviously heard a number of other comments and pros and cons that can be built into the paper. But in terms of Anne's suggestion about adding specific jurisdictional examples of individual consequences, my gut reaction is I don't think I can do that for January because I presume I would actually need to speak to each of those jurisdictions. I don't feel I could just... I mean, Australia, they've got a standard, as you say, issued earlier this year, so that is something we know. But for other jurisdictions, without actually speaking to them, I'm thinking...
I'm not sure that we can go there. I think we need to build our own analysis and thinking. I think we had a good discussion. I think a lot of good points were raised, interesting points in both different directions. I think that will give us a good basis personally for decision making. I think if anybody's got anything specific they want looked at that they didn't raise in the meeting, it'd be good for the staff to know that sort of sooner rather than later, because I'm sure that posting feels quite close with Christmas in between. And then if based on that analysis, you know, people still feel there wasn't enough to vote on, we could do something later. But I think at the moment it feels like there's quite a substantive basis for the discussion. Yeah.
Okay. That sounds good.
Right. Yeah. Michelle?
Yeah.
Well, I think on the jurisdictional one is quite a complicated one because different jurisdictions are going to be coming from different points because we know that jurisdictions have, you know, defined their own financial reporting framework and they're all a bit different. So I think it would be really difficult for us to draw any conclusions from any analysis that we did anyhow. So I would agree with your point, Sue. But I think in the paper we bring in January, we would look at options around, you know, making the decision. And then, as Francois said, looking at what we included in the exposure draft.
Yes. Because I think the important point is no matter where the board lands, obviously it's an important, we've had an important discussion that needs to be captured in the document for people to have the opportunity to comment on it. So we'll make sure that happens. All right. So I think that brings us to having a short break. Sorry about my dog. I suggest we break for 15 minutes and start again at 11 o'clock UK time. 15 minutes. Thank you.